City Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams. Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Potter.
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity they are authorized to represent. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Item 649, accept the report, pesticide-free parks.
Mr. Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Today we're receiving a report from Portland Parks and Recreation on a three-year trial program evaluating the success of our efforts to create some pesticide-free parks. As many members of the council remember, Parks set up the study in response to a 2004 request from the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, or NCAP, to manage Portland park sites without any pesticide use. Parks was excited about this opportunity and established a three-year trial program to test whether cultural practices, agricultural practices using hand labor from volunteers could substitute for pesticide use, and that these practices could also meet acceptable park standards and fiscal feasibility. And the outcome is positive and a success. So here to present this report is Astrid Dragoy from Parks and Megan Kempel from the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides. Take it away, Astrid.
Thank you very much, Mayor and Commissioners. I, like Dan said, my name is Astrid Dragoy, and I work for City of Portland Parks and Recreation as the West Zone manager. And I want to thank you all for allowing us this opportunity to present the three-year pesticide-free park trial program today. As Commissioner Saltzman noted, in the fall of 2004, Portland Parks and Recreation responded to a request from the pesticide-free partners that provided Portland Parks and Recreation, or that allowed Portland Park and Recreation to manage sites without any pesticides. This three-year program was to be tracked by Portland Parks and Recreation, and tracking included direct and indirect costs, level of public participation, and outcomes and impacts. We would then determine how successful it was in meeting Portland Park and Recreation goals and responsibilities. Important criteria for success included support of general and recreation park uses, satisfying bureau priorities, an adequate volunteer base, fulfillment of park user group needs, meeting park standards, and fiscal feasibility. Our staff developed criteria for trial site selection, including factors like weed pressure, existing park amenities, park size, location, and neighborhood interests. And staff chose Arbor Lodge Park, Sewell Crest, and Lair Hill in 2005. A memorandum of understanding was adopted by Portland Park and Recreation and the pesticide-free partners, and this memorandum of understanding outlined program goals, partner responsibilities, evaluation criteria, maintenance standards and practices, and volunteer coordination. Portland Park and Recreation worked with the partners to document and communicate acceptable park maintenance standards to assure park needs were fulfilled. A park maintenance guide, which was attached as part of our memorandum of understanding, was also provided to volunteers so that they were able to evaluate the weed control required at the parks. Portland Park and Recreation appointed a staff person to coordinate the program. The pesticide-free park coordinator role was approximately a quarter of an existing staff person workload. This position dealt with park infrastructure issues, training volunteers, and also responded to questions about the program. The pesticide-free partners, led by NCAP, dedicated a staff person to recruit volunteers for each of the pesticide-free designated neighborhood parks. It was understood that a consistent labor force would be required to maintain the parks at the level agreed in the MOU. Over the trial, 244 volunteers put in 1,374 hours removing weeds at our three parks. And at this level of volunteer labor, it was possible to keep weeds in the trial sites at levels comparable with other city parks. Now, this level is not weed-free, but at a level where weeds are determined not to have a detrimental effect on park users, infrastructure, and other goals. Adherence to park standards was aided by quarterly walkthroughs with representatives from park staff and the volunteers. These meetings also provided good positive communication between all the groups that were involved. Monthly work parties were posted on the park websites. And on a typical work day, the key volunteer would arrive and unlock the tool storage box, which you see a picture of here, and unload the tools. As the volunteers arrive, they sign in and they're assigned a task for the day. Portland Park and Recreation provides gloves as well as the tools required. And tasks range from shoveling mulch, pushing a wheelbarrow, spreading mulch, hand weeding, or weeding with hula hose. Weeds are collected and placed in bags or piles for pickup and disposed by Portland Park and Recreation maintenance staff. Propane flame weeding is carried out by designated volunteers who are trained to use a propane weeder to assure operation doesn't create a safety hazard or harm park property. And they usually worked at different times other than the main work party. Startup and ongoing costs were tracked. The startup activities included a memorandum of understanding development, volunteer training material development, selection of parks, creation of signs, flyers, and walkthrough forms and other activities. Infrastructure costs such as toolbox construction and placement and sign construction and installation were also part of the startup costs. Ongoing activities included ordering materials, delivering mulch, entering volunteer information into the database, filling propane tanks, repairs to signs, working at some of the work parties, hauling additional tools for large work parties, and quarterly walkthroughs and other activities. Average annual per park costs are shown on this slide. This table summarizes some of the inputs and compares the annual pesticide-free management costs versus the Portland Park and Recreation integrated pesticide management approach that was used prior to the pesticide-free park status at each of the three parks. Startup costs here are not included. The average startup costs for these three parks was approximately $9,500, and that's just a one-time startup cost. And then ongoing funding averaged, so I'm averaging across the line here, was about $3,620 per year per park. And our volunteer average hours was about 152 hours per park. And these numbers compared to an average of 371 total for materials, labor, per park per year using our traditional integrated pest management. The pesticide-free trial program created niche parks, which provided a service to residents who wish to visit a park where no pesticides are used. Though the cost of maintaining the parks is high compared to our current integrated pest management program management, the additional cost could be evaluated in light of our need to serve certain members of our community. The program also works towards a goal of our Vision 2020 plan, which engages residents as stewards of Portland's parks and recreation system to help preserve the legacy of future generations. The trial program also aided in achieving the goal of increasing the ratio of volunteer hours to paid staff hours. 244 people volunteered at least one day during these 3 years. It's expected that many of these volunteers have a heightened sense of what it takes to maintain Portland's parks at our current service levels. So what did we learn? What we learned during the trial was that there are specific ingredients that have to be in place in order for successful continuation of this program. And they include Portland Park and Recreation, labor and material cost, volunteer coordination duties of the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides staff member, and volunteer labor of local residents. We also find that as we review the condition of our three pesticide-free parks against predetermined success criteria that we established at the beginning of the trial, we can declare that this trial was a success. The three parks were successfully managed in the pesticide-free park style. Where do we go from here? Based on lessons learned, we recommend that any future parks be selected based on certain criteria. These criteria include choosing parks that are relatively small in size so as not to overwhelm the volunteer workforce. Parks should also have low weed pressures. They should have few shrub beds. And parks that are adjacent natural areas or that incorporate natural areas should be avoided, as we don't want to interfere with existing ongoing integrated pest management programs that are in place that for parks that have high invasive species pressures. Portland Parks staff is excited about the addition of choice to our park users. As park providers and land managers, we do also recognize that it is our responsibility to keep these public spaces maintained at acceptable levels. We will assure success through an updated memorandum of understanding, which will outline the levels of commitment required by all participants. Should public interest change, this memorandum of understanding would allow modification of management practices at our parks. I'd like to turn it over to Megan Kempel.
Thank you. My name is Megan Kempel. I'm Pesticide-Free Parks Program Coordinator with the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, also known as NCAP. I co-coordinate the program with Martin Nicholson of Portland Parks and Recreation, and I'm responsible for community outreach and volunteer recruitment and coordination. We really appreciate Portland Parks and Recreation's commitment to reducing pesticide use in our public spaces. We also really appreciate that Portland Parks and Rec has allocated staff time to this program. The partnership between NCAP and Portland Parks and Recreation has worked really well. We communicate regularly and we work well together. The pesticide-free parks look good. They get regular attention by volunteers. Key volunteers supervise work parties on the first weekend of every month. Our key volunteers at Arbor Lodge have been with us since October 2005. Linda Parrish is here. And our key volunteer at Sewell Crest has been with us since October 2005. Karen Goodall is here. The key volunteer at Lair Hill is the principal for the Cedarwood Waldorf School, which is next to the park. He's been in that role since June of 2007. The way that we conduct our community outreach is through a number of different avenues. We publish announcements in publications including the Portland Tribune's Sustainable Life Calendar, in Metro's Green Scene publication and website. We conduct outreach at community events, including Earth Day celebrations, the Better Living Show, the Salmon Festival. We make reminder phone calls and send email announcements to volunteers who've signed up. We also conduct outreach at events in the parks. Portlanders are supportive of this program. Since the beginning of the program, 1,700 Portlanders have signed petitions in support of the Pesticide-Free Parks program in Portland. I have those petitions here, and I'll deliver them to Commissioner Saltzman's office this afternoon. We are really looking forward to continuing this partnership and working with Portland Parks and Recreation on the program in the future. We, as an organization, are committed to being involved with the program and have staff dedicated to the program. We plan to continue in the role of coordinating community outreach, recruiting and coordinating volunteers as well. The startup costs, if the program is continued and expanded, will be less than during the trial period. The memorandum of understanding and details involved took a lot of time to work out, and we have those things figured out now. NCAP, our organization, has raised $3,600 through a grant from Bureau of Environmental Services to cover some of the startup costs for two new parks, including toolboxes and the pesticide-free park signs, so that money has been raised already. Portland Parks and Recreation and NCAP staff have also worked together to identify new parks which would work well if the program's expanded. We really look forward to continuing this partnership. Thanks for your time.
Thank you both. Any questions? I had one question. Yep. What are the propane burners you were talking about? Or what do they do?
They're pretty exciting. I think it's one of those opportunities that you have. If people say that parks are boring, you can say they absolutely are not. These are propane torches, and they're with canisters. And let's see. I actually have a picture of it here in our presentation. I don't know if you can see it
here. Use them on weeds?
Yeah, you use it on weeds, and we use it in our ball fields. So it's one of the ways that we do weed management.
Okay.
And it's not as if it's labor intensive. You have to go back and revisit, but it does kill the plant above ground, not the roots, but does take the plant out. Yeah.
What are the problems with using pesticides? I was looking for the information. Perhaps people at home would like to know. What are the problems that we are currently experiencing by using these as part of the integrated pest management program, what they call low toxicity herbicides? What is the problem by using those?
Well, there are certain folks that would like to be able to go to parks where there are no pesticides, and there's a zero tolerance for not having pesticides within parks. Portland Parks and Recreation is unique. We are salmon certified. We are a model nationally, and there are several other park districts that use our integrated pest management as their guide for how to maintain their parks. Salmon safe certification that we have means that the level of pesticides that we use is minimal. We use the lowest toxicity that is possible, and therefore we have been certified as salmon safe, meaning we can use our pesticide adjacent to streams and rivers where there is threatened salmon. So we're very proud of that.
So do the pesticides that's currently being used cause medical issues, or do they run off into the streams and cause problems in our streams? I'm trying to figure out what the problem is with the... I know no one likes pesticides, but I'm curious as to how the Parks Bureau views that.
Well, we like to be able to give people options, and I think that's what it comes down to. Like I said, it's part of Vision 2020 to provide those options for folks. And one of the great things about pesticide-free parks is that it does allow folks to connect with our park system, and to get to know people that live in the community. In order for this program to be successful, we need to have volunteers. It's not enough that people say, I think it's great that we have pesticide-free parks. They actually have to come out and they have to do the work. It was 1,374 hours of labor. So,
I was actually curious to the answer to the question the mayor asked too. What is specifically the concern with the pesticides that you use?
I think that the concern that, well, maybe Megan would like to answer that since she's with the Pesticide Free Partners.
I represent an organization whose mission it is to reduce the use of pesticides in the Northwest. And our view is that pesticides can cause harm to human health and the environment. And that's a pretty commonly recognized concern in the Pacific Northwest especially. And we have, I think, both our organization and Portland Parks and Recreation has specifically tried to respond to that concern that community members have about exposure to pesticides. There are individuals who have unusually reactive responses to pesticide exposure that are unlike what most of us would experience. So there are individuals with multiple chemical sensitivity who are especially susceptible. I think what we were responding to was maybe those folks who need special places to be in order to respond to that disability. But I think more generally, just a general concern about exposure to pesticides in terms of environmental health and human health, and trying to respond to the public's concern about that.
So I'm going to try one more time. You're using a very broad definitions, and I'm very concerned about the specific pesticides, specifically Roundup seems to be referred to a lot. Is there a specific, beyond a perception and beyond what people think, but is there a specific concern about the use of Roundup? And if so, what is that?
Mayor Potter, members of the council, Dave McAllister, city nature manager. To be the most direct in our minds, there is little to zero risk of using the chemicals, particularly Roundup, as you have outlined. It's readily decomposed in the soil. It has a very short-lived toxicity that's very specific to the target species. We feel that using label instructions that there is very little to no risk to any of the general public. Now, that isn't to say that you could drink a lot of it or there are some other additional things, but no, under the label prescriptions, the way we use our products, we feel very confident there's no risk to the public.
Thank you.
But the we're struggling with these issues as part of our invasive plant species strategy and round the under the brand name Roundup. It's my understanding, just one tiny little bit of information, is that the sticking agent is really bad for invertebrates. So. And has a longer life than the chemical used to kill the plant, but they used to keep the chemical stuck on the plant. It has some pretty devastating impacts if it gets into the habitat where invertebrates are at. It can be a problem.
That was very good. And one of the things that I would...
Fully impressed. I mean, I'm...
That was very good. a short comment on the IPM program.
Use your hair.
Well, I use a lot of Roundup, is why I asked. And so, you know,
maybe Randy and I have been drinking the same thing here.
I will quit drinking it, though, after the day.
The nature of the IPM program, and that's really what we're talking about, and this is indirectly what Commissioner Adams, touches on, is this is a very organic program that we're doing. We're constantly assessing the very thing that you're talking about, Commissioner Adams. We're looking at those toxicities. We learn new information. We're correcting our program, constantly trying to reduce, if we get new information, reducing those ancillary or non-target impacts. So, you know, perhaps you've heard that we've taken all of the golf courses off of any use on the turf of any chemicals because we found another substitute for it. So we're always looking for that, and that's the nature of the IPM program. It's not static. It's continually dynamic, always looking at it, and the overall goal is to do absolutely minimize any use of pesticides, number one, and to absolutely zero their non-target impacts.
So is that your way of very politely and professionally saying Commissioner Adams was full of BS?
I'm not going to go there.
To that
I'm
question.
There's no answer.
You know, what I might suggest, because I guess the confusing part for me is that when I look to see why you're doing it, there's nothing that really says, here's the problem. Pesticides do this to the environment. Pesticides do this to the invertebrates. Pesticide does this to our rivers. It would really be good to say, you know, because all this stuff washes down and eventually ends up in our streams, it would be nice to have something that you could weigh it against, so you could at least say, you know, by doing this, we're reducing the compounds that are found in our local rivers. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think would resonate rather than the results were that it met park standards. You know, that doesn't mean a lot to folks. And I'm just suggesting, because I, too, have concerns about pesticides, and I would like the public to be concerned, but they've got to have a reason, and I think it's not really well stated here.
Appreciate that comment.
Okay. Thank you, folks.
I think there's people signed up for testimony.
How many folks? Did you have any folks you wanted to testify?
No, we didn't have any.
Okay. How many folks signed up?
We have 5 people.
Okay. Please call the first 3.
Linda Paris, Karen Goodall, and Andy Seaton.
Hi there. Hi. My name is Linda Parrish, and I'm the key volunteer at Arbor Lodge Park in North Portland. Monthly, we get volunteers in the park, including neighbors that live very near to the park. Students from University of Portland have come out numerous times to help. And we'll occasionally get corporate groups who bring people in, and they'll help us do bigger projects like spreading the mulch and that sort of thing. We have a lot of support from the park users. Arbor Lodge is a heavily used park. We have an off-leash dog area, so many times when we're in the parks, we'll have pet owners that will approach us, and they'll appreciate what we're doing, and they'll say that they'll bring their pet specifically to that park because they know that there's no risk to their animals. And Arbor Lodge has 2 ball fields. At this time of the year, they're very busy. constantly having ball games. And we'll get comments from the parents and coaches about the parks, too. And it's a great opportunity for us to meet people in the neighborhood and talk about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and also generate the interest to let them know that the park is pesticide-free and that they're welcome to come and help out at any time. All they have to do is show up, and we provide all the materials necessary.
Hello, my name is Karen Goodall, and I'm the key volunteer at Sewell Crest Park in Southeast Portland. And we also are very supported by the neighborhoods that live near us, and often people have come to visit the park from different places around town. So I wanted to say that the support seems to be very broad when I've talked to people. We also have one ball field on our park, and so the teams, when I've talked to the coaches, they're very pleased that it's something that some of this is like it doesn't enter people's minds until they really stop and think about it, that a ball field maybe would be cleared with an herbicide, and that herbicide, when the child then, you know, does his slide through the bases and touch, you know, has the whatever residue is on his hands and then goes, you know, touches his face and whatever, you know. So a lot of people, that residual amount is a concern to people when you're saying, you know, what does a chemical do? Well, it hasn't, and what I've always heard is it hasn't really been proven, but you know, we're talking about children. These are playgrounds where children are at, young families, and also their dog parks. So those are more sensitive individuals, and that exposure, or, you know, to have zero exposure, I think, is what some of the families that I've talked to, they're real pleased about zero exposure. The other is sometimes when I've talked to the people come, you know, it's just a community gathering time. I mean, sure, we're pulling weeds and we're having a dull I'm not saying it's dull, but it's able to have a time to share a conversation, to meet one of your neighbors. Sometimes, too, I've had families come out, both mothers or fathers, and bring in their children. They're telling their children, this is the park you play at. It's your turn to give back to your community, and let's do a little work, you know, like I said, give back. It's the place where you play, so we're then come and take care of it. So there's that in neighborhood involvement, community feeling. We're also, my park, Sewell Crest, is located right next to a community garden. So that, once again, is a organic, no pesticides are used there. So we are right joining the fence. And how crazy is it to have one side of the fence have one set of rules and the other side another? So I'm very pleased on that. We've always had enough volunteers. So we have some that are repeat, come back a lot of time, and some come just to check out, see what we're doing, and hear about it there. And also, you know, maybe also part of one thing that I haven't heard mentioned is it's kind of a behavior change. They learn that, hey, the park can be maintained well, looks good how we're doing with a little physical control. So let's go home and let's change what we're using in our home backyards. And that would have the broader environmental impact as well. So I'm very dedicated. You know, we're all passionate about our community, our environment, and, you know, starting local and enjoying our parks. Thank you very much.
My name's Andy Seaton. I'm not exactly a chemical expert, but I did work for 2 years with Roan Poulenc R&D Center that made pesticides, research pesticides for a living. And although Roundup is from another company, I would just like to point out that it is not specific to the target weeds it's being put on. Basically, it kills any plant with roots, and which is pretty much almost all of them. So, I would counter that. I'm also, from the presentation, a little surprised to hear that they're not considering pesticide-free parks in parks that are adjacent to or contain natural areas, since one of the main concerns that you're worried about is runoff into the natural areas of these pesticides, which can hurt native plants that you're trying to keep alive and to spread. So the fact that they're automatically excluding natural area parks from the program does worry me. Going through the chart on Table 1, I found some inconsistencies. Money-wise, it's hard to calculate what the total costs per year are because there's no rate that I could find for the non-Portland Parks and Recreation labor hours. So I don't know what that is. You know, the 144 hours per year translates into some amount of money, and also under the total weed management costs, column under IPM doesn't seem to add up, because 371 plus 19 equals 390, 92, not 370, 92. And the other thing that I did notice from a couple of pages before, there was not included in the, they have their herbicide application labor costs and herbicide costs, but that there is another item which almost doubles that, more than doubles that in some of these situations, which is travel and prep time. Which comes out to significantly more than 370 or 390. So, you know, these are some just basic raw concerns about looking at the report here in the short amount of time I've had to take a look at it. I ended up talking to my lawyer over lunch, who I called while I was in the process of being arrested. Thank you very much for not following through on that. And my personal metric here, I must say that I'm using an assumption that $600 a month is a good rate for a single apartment, single room apartment. I'm going to check with whatever state or local agency would know that. I guess Portland Housing Authority, what a single bedroom apartment would run. But the three times the startup costs would be 3.93 apartment years, and the net difference between IPM and PFP is we're paying for an additional 1.35 apartment years to do this. So although I like the idea, it is something to keep in mind. Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Call the next step.
Last two are Mike D. and Linda Robinson.
Thanks for being here. When you speak, state your name for the record. You each have 3 minutes.
All right. Thank you. Mike D. I'm sorry, my testimony specifically on the Pesticide-Free Parks trial program and the documentation won't be as educational as I was hoping, because they only had a copy for review down there. I guess Andy got the copy that was available for the public, but he did hand it over to me now. But when I heard that the Pesticide-Free Parks program only included three parks, I heard this years ago. I've been signed up on their mailing list, and so I've actually looked into this. I'm only included three parks. I was amazed. I was like, what? I thought all the parks in Portland were pesticide-free. It seemed like a no-brainer to me. I was very happy to – yeah. Oh, so I went to check in about, you know, some of the pesticides that are used there. And you're right on with your questions. The city is going to be liable for the chemicals that are being put in these parks. You're using Roundup. Roundup's not your friend. It's a Monsanto product. Genetic engineering's involved. So this is some serious stuff here. It contains a glyphosate 41%. It 59% includes a polyethoxylene lanamide, also known as POEA, and isopropylamine, and the amounts undisclosed, and an identity of remaining ingredients withheld by the manufacturer because they're trade secrets. So we can't tell you what some of the stuff is in there. It's secret. So what are some of the things that come from this? Systemic and respiratory acute illness. Roundup inhibits enzymes involved in the detoxification of chemicals in the body. So basically it attacks your vital body's organs that actually process toxins to your body. It has cancerous effects. It's involved in gene mutation. It's a reproductive toxin. There's lots of carcinogens. There's severe eye irritants involved. You heard some testimony on that. Both skin and eye irritation, impaired lung function, salivary gland abnormalities. And so glyphosate's bad. POEA is three times as acutely bad. It's acutely toxic. Also known for irritating eyes and skin, gastrointestinal problems, probable humane carcinogen. It's also caused cardiac arrest. I'm running out of time here. There's lots of information. The Northwest RAGE, the Northwest Resistance Against Genetic Engineering, has lots of information on Roundup And us with me with the Liberation Collective are concerned about this being used and think it's a no-brainer. All parks should be pesticide-free. And I have more information if you'd like to hear it, but I know my time's up. Thank you.
I'm Linda Robinson. Before I retired 5 or 6 years ago, I spent the last 7 or 8 years of my work life creating and helping to create and run the Naturescaping for Clean Rivers program, which was part of the city's NPDES permit for stormwater runoff, and it's the outreach to the public to try to clean up the water that comes off of residential yards. And we encourage people to use little or no pesticides, including Roundup and slug bait and all sorts of other things. And there are a number of reasons. Pets are especially sensitive to these chemicals on the lawn, particularly if they're allowed in the area soon after it's applied. Toddlers. But the big thing is the bees and butterflies, and we have a major problem with our bee population, and we don't want to, we need pollination in order to have food and other things, so that's a big question. But the other thing is setting the example and the educational value of the public being able to see what you can do in terms of maintenance without using these chemicals. Because, the city parks employees have certain training and they apply them in certain ways, but when the public sees them applied, the public is not always as careful. They see these yellow rings around the trees, and, oh, okay, that's the thing to do. You apply Roundup around the trees. But they tend to use too much. They tend to do it at the wrong time. They tend to not apply them properly, wear the proper gear, and have it running off because they maybe over-apply it. So to me, it's a setting an example and a very good educational opportunity and an opportunity for people to get involved with and take some ownership in their local park as well. So I see the values beyond just the controlling this specific weed on a specific circle around a tree. So I would encourage you to continue this program. I'm involved with a group that has recently planted a butterfly garden at Midland Park adjacent to the Midland Library. And Midland is being considered as a park to be added to that. It's a little 2-acre park. We would like to see the pesticide-free because butterflies are particularly sensitive to chemicals, and hopefully our butterfly garden will be a success if we can have a pesticide-free park.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That it?
That's all who signed up.
Okay, Anita.
I would move to accept the report.
Second.
Call the vote.
Adams?
Very impressive report, and I'm glad to see that it's all working out as envisioned, and thanks for the partnership. Aye.
Leonard.
And I agree. Aye.
Saltzman.
This is a quality piece of work. I want to express my thanks to Parks and NCAP. I also want to recognize we have the two people that make this program work with us, John Reed and Martin Nicholson, also here in the background. I want to thank you for your work. And I think the trial program clearly shows that parks can be managed effectively without any pesticide use if there is the committed group of volunteers to assist with management and the staff available to corral that energy. And while the study does show it does increase maintenance costs when parks are managed in this fashion, it also shows, I think, that there are benefits of increased community support for parks, knowledge of park maintenance challenges, and pesticide-free options, providing actual pesticide-free options, as many of our citizens strongly desire in their park system. So we have three parks that are currently pesticide-free, Lair Hill, Arbor Lodge, and Sewell Crest. I want to announce today that we're going to establish two more parks, and we're going to distribute them such that we'll have one pesticide-free park in each of 5 zones throughout the city. So Parks and NCAP will be working to come back to us at a later point to identify and let us know what the two additional parks are. So I'm pleased to vote aye.
Potter.
Good work, folks. Aye. Please read the 2:30 time certain.
Item 650, urge the United States Congress to pass binding legislation that ratifies the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child.
Commissioner Leonard.
Good morning, Mayor Potter and members of the council and assembled guests. A few months ago, my office was approached by Professor Jessica Ritter of Pacific University and some of her students. As part of a project for their sociology class, they're interested in passing a resolution on children's rights in Portland. They were originally interested in having Portland pass a children's bill of rights, but they were surprised and delighted when they found out we already had one, thanks to Mayor Potter's work. Working with my office and the mayor's office, the students crafted an ordinance to urge the United States Congress to ratify the UN's Convention on Rights of the Child, an international law instituted in 1990 and ratified by 193 countries across the world. Here to talk about the Convention on the Rights of the Child and what it means for Portland are Pacific University students Jean Lechever. Did I get that right? Lechever. I have it actually written out for me. Lechever. Jean Lechever and Celeste Goulding. We also have a representative from the Multnomah County Youth Commission that I'd also like to call up. So if you guys would come forward, I'd appreciate it. If you could just please come forward. Thank you.
Was there a third person? Right
there? There was. Do we have somebody from the Multnomah County Youth Commission here? Okay, great. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jean Lechever. I'm a student at Pacific.
I'm Celeste Goulding. I'm also a student at Pacific studying social work.
As you said, we're presenting here trying to encourage you to pass a resolution supporting an international treaty called the Convention on the Rights of the Child that's proposed by the UN as a Bill of Rights for Children. Currently, the United States is one of two countries that is still needed to ratify it, the other one being Somalia. The UN secures basic rights for children everywhere, primarily focusing on the inherent right to life. But there are many other subparts of this treaty. Special attention I'd like to draw to the rights of a child to express his or her views freely in all matters affecting them, the child's right to protection from all forms of abuse, both mentally and physically. The rights of every child who is seeking refugee status has the right to receive appropriate protection and humanitarian assistance. Also, that every child has the right to the highest attainable standard of health and to facilities for the treatment of illness and the rehabilitation of health. Also, the rights to the standard of living adequate for the child's physical, mental, spiritual, moral, and social development, the right to education, and finally, the right to be protected from all forms of sexual exploitation and sexual abuse. As I mentioned, there's many other provisions for this, many of them referring to privacy and the right to freedom of thoughts, freedom of assemblies. Basically, this legislation is proposing that the rights that we grant to humans regarding their mental and physical well-being should also be granted to children as members of the community. And Celeste will tell you a little bit more about why this is needed.
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you, Jean. So I just want to start, excuse me if I start coughing. I'm sorry about that. And to begin with, there are 9.7 million children that die annually before their fifth birthday due to malnutrition, illness, lack of health care, lack of resources, and just general lack of care. There's 143 million who are underweight due to extreme poverty and just lack of resources. And there's 1.2 million that are trafficked every year for uses in the sex industry and cheap labor industry. And the Convention on the Rights of the Child will remedy many of these problems internationally if adopted by all 193 countries that are part of the UN. It's very important for the U.S. to sign this because even though we are one of the industrialized nations and we are leading the world on an economic front, we're still ranked like 156 out of 190 as far as our infant or under five death rate goes. We have 7 per 1,000 children under the age of 5 dying in our country each year. We have 1,682,900 homeless youth living on the streets of our cities in this country. There's a general lack of attention being paid to our children because there's so much attention focused on the adult, on the problems facing the adult population, that the children are often just left in the responsibility of their parents, but parents aren't always capable of caring for their children. And 1 in 9 children are uninsured in this country, so probably has a lot to do with why there's 7 per 1,000 dying each year. And these are just some numbers that represent the importance of this document and the importance of our government ratifying it and instigating its measures. And it would really help if Portland as a city would sign our resolution asking the country to ratify it. And hopefully that would also pressure our Oregon Senate to sign a similar resolution pressuring the U.S. to sign it. And we would be joining one of, it looks like, about 9-10 cities and like 6 states that have signed similar resolutions.
We'd also like to bring attention to the fact that I believe that Portland likes to view itself as a very progressive city. We like to think of ourselves as being on the front of human rights. And I think that it's important for us to look past the rights of the children here in Oregon and look at them on a national and international level. We already have a Bill of Rights for Children here in the state, and this passing this resolution at an international level would help pressure our national government to provide the same rights for children everywhere.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gina and Celeste.
There's got to be a good story why the United States and Somalia are the only two countries that haven't ratified this.
There's really not. United States.
It's just, it's an oversight by the president and the Congress.
It's been pushed. It's been put in front of Senate a few times. Do you remember how many times?
I don't remember how many times. I think it just kind of goes along our history of not signing on to international treaties.
I think both countries have juntas.
It's not our history. It's in a policy of the current administration.
Policy of the current
administration. I think we all look forward to that changing very soon.
Yes.
This has been around since 98. It was when this first hit the U.S. government. So a couple administrations have had a shot at it at this point.
Well, thanks for bringing this forward.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Is that all the invited testimony? How many folks signed up?
With 3 people signed up.
Can you call them forward, please?
Andrew Seaton, James Donahue, and Mike D.
State your name when you testify. You each have 3 minutes.
My name is still Andy Seaton. It's interesting the fact that this is part of or similar to something called the Convention or Declaration of Human Rights was put together by Eleanor Roosevelt after she left the White House in company after World War II. It was one of the first big pushes within the United Nations, and it was saw a very interesting movie starring I forget her name, Edith from All in the Family, I think, was playing her, and the battles they fought with the Russians to not get it vetoed. But the interesting thing is that there's really kind of 2 parts to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There's the sort of political rights and rights of free speech and things like that that are enshrined in our Bill of Rights. But there's also economic rights that are in the Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Things like a right to work, a right to housing, a right to good food, and that sort of thing. And the funny thing is that the United States has only ratified half of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, despite the good work of Eleanor Roosevelt. All of the economic parts of the treaty have not been ratified by the United States. And I was asking the women from Pacific University what the status is. It's a little unclear from the resolution here as to whether it's been ratified, signed by the U.S. and or ratified by the Senate. And there's also a third step that needs to be done for international treaties, which is constitutionally iffy, since the Constitution says that treaties and the Constitution have equal standing, but it's been ruled by the courts that there has to be enabling legislation part of U.S. code to implement the items in any given treaty. So the question is, and they're saying this hasn't been ratified by the Senate, but even if it's ratified by the Senate, there are some locations. Some treaties that there's no enabling legislation, so there's no way to sue if it's being violated or work on it. So, you know, and one of the fundamental right to have a good place to live is what's going on, the argument that's been going on out in front of here. You know, and an interesting comment from earlier was some of the contracts saying they couldn't find women, minorities, or emerging small business subcontractors for construction jobs. And it occurred to me over lunch that many of the homeless folks that I've met work construction when they do have work. And, you know, if you want to talk about an emerging small business, just look out the front window here. And see what's going on. And I was talking to some of the folks out there that, you know, wouldn't even have a clue as to who to go to talk to. I mean, even who to begin to talk to find out, you know, how to get work as a minority or as an emerging small business or what you want to call it. So you want to find some way to get folks off the street, then, you know, find some gainful employment for them. So, you know, that would be a good way to solve two problems. And that's about it for my time. Thank you very much for putting up with me today.
My name is James Donahue. I was walking back from lunch with this guy, Mr. Seaton, and asked him what was on the agenda. He said that this children's rights thing is on the agenda. And as I was walking across the street, I saw a sign out there. It said one of the people out camping said housing is a human right. Kind of fit together. I don't know exactly if the Declaration of Children's Rights includes housing, but I don't know. I think that is so fundamental that it might not even be addressed. They need, Portland, I don't know. The fact that the U.S. isn't ratifying these treaties says something about the U.S. and the nature of our the separatism, we feel arrogance almost. We feel like we're better than everybody else. Why does Portland need to ratify this children's amendment if we're gonna and you know? Make it okay, and ratify the Children's Amendment and say, you know, the children get all these rights when homeless people, which do include children, there are children out there as a part of the homeless community, do not enjoy the same kind of rights. I don't know. It almost seems hypocritical to me. Thank you.
Mike D. Children have rights as human beings and also need special care and protection. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is built on varied legal systems and cultural traditions. The Convention is a universally agreed set of non-negotiable standards and obligations. These basic standards are called human rights, set minimum entitlements and freedoms that should be respected by governments. They are founded on respect for the dignity and worth of each individual, regardless of race, color, gender, language, religion, opinions, origins, wealth, birth status, or ability, and therefore apply to every human being everywhere. With these rights comes the obligation on both governments and individuals to not infringe on the parallel rights of others. These standards are both interdependent and indivisible. We cannot ensure some rights without or at the expense of other rights. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is the first legally binding international instrument to incorporate the full range of human rights, civil, cultural, economic, political, and social rights. In 1989, world leaders decided that children needed a special convention just for them because people under 18 years old often need special care and protection that adults do not. The leaders also wanted to make sure that the world recognized that children have human rights too. The convention sets out these rights in 54 articles and two optional protocols. It spells out the basic human rights that children everywhere have. The right to survival, to develop to the fullest, to protection from harmful influences, abuse and exploitation, and to participate fully in family, cultural, and social life. The four core principles of the convention are non-discrimination, devotion to the best interests of the child, the right to survive, the right to life, survival and development, and respect for the views of the child. Every right spelled out in the convention is inherent to the human dignity and harmonious development of the child. The convention protects children's rights by setting standards in healthcare, education, and legal, civil, and social services. By agreeing to undertake the obligations of the convention, by ratifying or acceding to it, national governments have committed themselves to protecting and ensuring children's rights, and they have agreed to hold themselves accountable for this commitment before the international community. States parties to the convention are obligated to develop and undertake all actions and policies in light of the best interests of the child. I think it would be in the city's interest to also jump on board of this convention. And I would like to remind you that all of us here in Portland, once we reach past the age of 18, we're also children. So we're also children of the city, and some of us are right outside. Thanks. Bye.
That's all who signed up.
Thank you.
Okay, this is a resolution. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Thank you, Professor Ritter, for bringing this forward. Thank you, Jean and Celeste, for your great testimony and your work on this. This is a very excellent idea to bring forward, to have the council forward to the United States Congress. Upon the passage of this, we will be sending it directly to our congressional delegation. And if we get it before the Senate, you can watch C-SPAN and tell everybody I made that happen. Aye.
Saltzman.
And Randy will let you know because he'll be watching.
That's right. So,
no, this is good work. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention, and I'm pleased that Portland is joining other cities and states and urging its ratification. Thank you. Aye.
Potter.
And I think this certainly complements and supports what the youth of Portland did in creating the Children and Youth Bill of Rights last year. And so I see this as validating that, but also reinforcing the need to make sure that all countries, including the United States, comply with it and make sure that all children receive their full rights. So thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. I vote aye. Adjourned until next week.